and it stretches over nearly 6,000 square miles. According to the United Nations Environment Program, Manu is possibly the most biologically diverse protected area in the world. Many species can be found only in the park and its immediate environs. These include the tree fern Ciathea multisegmenta, a bird known as the white-cheeked toady flycatcher, a rodent called Barbara Brown's brush-tailed rat, and a small black toad known only by its Latin name, Rhinella manu. The first night on the trail, one of Silman's students, Rudy Cruz, insisted that we all go out looking for Rhinella manu. He had seen several of the toads during a previous visit to the spot, and he felt sure we could find them again if we tried. I'd recently read a paper on the spread of the chytrid fungus to Peru. According to the authors, it had already arrived in Manu, but I decided not to mention this. Perhaps Rhinella manu was still out there, in which case I certainly wanted to see it. We strapped on headlamps and set out down the trail, like a line of coal miners filing down a shaft. The forest at night had become an impenetrable tangle of black. Cruz led the way, shining his lamp along the tree trunks and peering into the bromeliads. The rest of us followed suit. This went on for maybe an hour and turned up only a few brownish frogs from the genus Pristimantis. After a while, people started getting bored and drifting back to camp. Cruz refused to give up. Perhaps thinking that the problem was the rest of us, he headed up the trail in the opposite direction. "Did you find anything?" someone would periodically call out to him through the darkness. "Nada," came the repeated response. The next day, after more arcane discussions about tree measurements, we packed up to continue down the ridge. On a trip to fetch water, Silman had found a spray of white berries interspersed with what looked like purple-bright streamers. He'd identified the arrangement as the inflorescence of a tree in the Brassicaceae, or mustard family, but he had never seen anything quite like it before, which made him think, he told me, that it might represent yet another new species. It was pressed in newspaper for transport down the mountain. The idea that I might have been present at the discovery of a species, even though I'd had absolutely nothing to do with it, filled me with an odd sort of pride. Back on the trail, Silman hacked away with his machete, pausing every now and then to point out a new botanical oddity, like a shrub that steals water from its neighbors by sticking out needle-like roots. Silman talks about plants the way other people speak about movie stars. One tree he described to me as charismatic. Others were hilarious, crazy, neat, clever, and amazing. Sometime in the mid-afternoon, we emerged onto a rise with a view across a valley to the next ridge. On the ridge, the trees were shaking. This was a sign of woolly monkeys making their way through the forest. Everyone stopped to try to get a glimpse of them. As they sailed from branch to branch, the monkeys made a chirruping noise, a bit like the whine of crickets. Silman pulled out the shopping bag and passed it around. A little while later, we reached Plot 6, elevation 7,308 feet, where the tree from the new genus had been found. Silman waved his machete at it. The tree looked pretty ordinary, but I tried to see it through his eyes. It was taller than most of its neighbors. Perhaps it could be described as stately or statuesque, with smooth, ruddy bark and simple alternate leaves. It belonged to the Euphorbiaceae, or spurge family, whose members include poinsettia. Silman was eager to learn as much as possible about the tree, so that when a new taxonomist could be found to replace the one who had died, he'd be able to send him all the necessary material. He and Farfan went to see what they could come up with. They returned with some seed capsules, which were as thick and tough as hazelnut shells, but delicately shaped, like flowering lilies. The capsules were dark brown on the outside, and inside the color of sand. That evening, The sun set before we reached Plot 8, where we were going to camp. We hiked on through the dark, then set up our tents and made dinner, also in the dark. I crawled into my sleeping bag around 9 p.m., but a few hours later, I was woken by a light. I assumed someone had gotten up to pee and rolled over. In the morning, Silman told me that he was surprised I'd been able to sleep through all the commotion. Six groups of cocaleros had tromped through the campsite overnight. In Peru, though the sale of coca is legal, all purchases are supposed to go through a government agency known as INACO, a restriction growers do their best to avoid. Every single group had tripped over his tent. Eventually, he'd gotten so annoyed, he'd yelled at the cocaleros, which, he had to admit, probably hadn't been the wisest idea. In ecology, rules are hard to come by. One of the few that's universally accepted is the species-area relationship, or SAR, which has been called the closest thing the discipline has to a periodic table. In its broadest formulation, the species-area relationship seems so simple as to be almost self-evident. The larger the area you sample, the greater the number of species you will encounter. This pattern was noted all the way back in the 1770s by Johann Reinhold Forster, a naturalist who sailed with Captain Cook on his second voyage, the one after his unfortunate collision with the Great Barrier Reef. In the 1920s, it was codified mathematically by a Swedish botanist, Olof Arrhenius. As it happens, Olof was the son of the chemist Svante Arrhenius, who, in the 1890s, showed that burning fossil fuels would lead to a warmer planet. And it was further refined and elaborated by E.O. Wilson and his colleague Robert MacArthur in the 1960s. The correlation between the number of species and the size of the area is not linear. Rather, it's a curve that slopes in a predictable way. Usually, the relationship is expressed by the formula S equals CA to the Z, where S is the number of species, A is the size of the area, and C and Z are constants that vary according to the region and taxonomic group under consideration, and hence are not really constants in the usual sense of the term. The relationship counts as a rule because the ratio holds no matter what the terrain. You could be studying a chain of islands or a rainforest or a nearby state park, and you'd find that the number of species varies according to the same insistent equation, S equals CA to the Z. It's important to note that Z is always less than 1, usually somewhere between 0.20 and 0.35. For the purposes of thinking about extinction, the species-area relationship is key. One admittedly simplified way of conceiving of what humans are doing to the world is that we are everywhere changing the value of A. Consider, for example, a grassland that once covered 1,000 square miles. Let's say the grassland was home to 100 species of birds, or beetles, or snakes. If half of the grassland were eliminated, converted into farmland or shopping malls, it should be possible to calculate, using the species-area relationship, the proportion of bird species, or beetles or snakes, that would be lost. Very roughly speaking, the answer is 10%. Here again, it's important to remember that the relationship is not linear. Since it takes a long time for the system to reach a new equilibrium, you wouldn't expect the species to disappear right away, but you would expect them to be headed in that direction. In 2004, a group of scientists decided to use the species-area relationship to generate a first-pass estimate of the extinction risk posed by global warming. First, the members of the team gathered data on the current ranges of more than 1,000 plant and animal species. Then they correlated these ranges with present-day climate conditions. Finally, they imagined the two extreme scenarios. In one, all of the species were assumed to be inert, much like the ilex trees in Silman's plots. As temperatures rose, they stayed put, and so in most cases the amount of climatically suitable area available to them shrank, in many cases down to zero. The projections based on this no-dispersal scenario were bleak. If warming were held to a minimum, the team estimated that between 22% and 31% of the species would be committed to extinction by 2050. If warming were to reach what was at that point considered a likely maximum, a figure that now looks too low, by the middle of this century, between 38% and 52% of the species would be fated to disappear. Here's another way to express the same thing. Anthony Barnosky, a paleontologist at the University of California, Berkeley, wrote of the study results. Look around you. Kill half of what you see. Or, if you're feeling generous, just kill about a quarter of what you see. That's what we could be talking about. In the second, more optimistic scenario, species were imagined to be highly mobile. Under this scenario, as temperatures climbed, creatures were able to colonize any new areas that met the climate conditions they were adapted to. Still, many species ended up with nowhere to go. As the Earth warmed, the conditions they were accustomed to simply disappeared. The disappearing climates turned out to be largely in the tropics. Other species saw their habitat shrink because to track the climate they had to move upslope, and the area at the top of a mountain is smaller than at the base. Using the universal dispersal scenario, the team, led by Chris Thomas, a biologist at the University of York, found that with the minimum warning projected, 9% to 13% of all species would be committed to extinction by 2050. With maximum warning, the numbers would be 21% to 32%. Taking the average of the two scenarios and looking at a mid-range warming projection, the group concluded that 24% of all species would be heading toward extinction. The study ran as the cover article in Nature. In the popular press, the welter of numbers the researchers came up with was condensed down to just one. Climate change could drive 1 million of the world's species to extinction, the BBC declared. By 2050, warming to doom 1 million species, is how the headline in National Geographic put it. The study has since been challenged on a number of grounds. It ignores interactions between organisms. It doesn't account for the possibility that plants and animals can tolerate a broader range of climates than their current range suggests. It looks only as far as 2050, when, under any remotely plausible scenario, warming will continue far beyond that. It applies the species-area relationship to a new, and therefore untested, set of conditions. More recent studies have come down on both sides of the Nature paper. Some have concluded that the paper overestimated the number of extinctions likely to be caused by climate change, others that it understated it. For his part, Thomas has acknowledged that many of the objections to the 2004 paper may be valid. But he has pointed out that every estimate that's been proposed since then has been the same order of magnitude. Thus, he's observed, around 10% or more of species and not 1% or 0.01% are likely to be done in by climate change. In a recent article, Thomas suggested that it would be useful to place these numbers in a geological context. Climate change alone is unlikely to generate a mass extinction as large as one of the Big Five, he wrote. However, there's a high likelihood that climate change on its own could generate a level of extinction on par with or exceeding the slightly lesser extinction events of the past. The potential impacts, he concluded, support the notion that we have recently entered the Anthropocene. The Brits like to mark everything in plastic, Silman told me. We think it's kind of gauche. It was our third day on the trail, and we were standing in plot 8. Where we'd come across a strip of blue tape outlining the plot's border. Silman suspected that it was the handiwork of colleagues of his from Oxford. Silman spends a lot of time in Peru, sometimes months at a stretch, but much of the year he's not there, and all sorts of things can happen that he doesn't know about, and usually doesn't care for. For instance, on our trip, Silman found several wire baskets that had been suspended in the tree plots to catch seeds. Clearly they'd been set up for research purposes, but no one had told him about them or asked his permission, and so they represented a sort of scientific piracy. I imagined rogue researchers creeping through the forest like cocoleros. In Plot 8, Silman introduced me to another really interesting tree, Alsate verticillata. Alsate verticillata is unusual in that it is the only species in its genus, and even more unusual in that it's the only species in its family. It has papery, bright green oblong leaves and small white flowers, which, according to Silman, smell like burnt sugar when in bloom. Alsate verticillata can grow to be very tall, and at this particular elevation, around 5,900 feet, it is the dominant canopy tree in the forest. It is one of those species that seem to be just sitting there motionless. Silman's plots represent another response to Thomas, one that's practical rather than theoretical. Trees are obviously a lot less mobile than, say, trogons, tropical birds common in Manu, or even ticks. But in a cloud forest, trees structure the ecosystem, much as corals structure a reef. Certain types of insects depend on certain types of trees, and certain sorts of birds depend on those insects, and so on up the food chain. The reverse is also true. Animals are critical to the survival of the forest. They are the pollinators and seed dispersers, and the birds prevent the insects from taking over. At the very least, Silman's work suggests, global warming will restructure ecological communities. Different groups of trees will respond differently to warming, and so contemporary associations will break down. New ones will form. In this planet-wide restructuring, some species will thrive. Many plants may in fact benefit from high carbon dioxide levels, since it will be easier for them to obtain the CO2 they need for photosynthesis. Others will fall behind and eventually drop out. Silman sees himself as an upbeat person. This is, or at least was, reflected in his research. My lab has kind of been the sunshine lab, he told me. He has argued publicly that with better policing and well-placed reserves, many threats to biodiversity, illegal logging, mining, ranching, could be minimized. Even in tropical areas, we know how to stop this stuff, he said. We're getting better governance. But in a rapidly warming world, the whole idea of a well-placed reserve becomes, if not exactly moot, then certainly a lot more problematic. In contrast to, say, a logging crew, climate change cannot be forced to respect a border. It will alter the conditions of life in Manu just as surely as it will alter them in Cusco or Lima. And with so many species on the move, a reserve that's fixed in place is no stay against loss. This is a qualitatively different set of stresses that we are putting on species, Silman told me. In other kinds of human disturbances, there were always spatial refuges. Climate affects everything. Like ocean acidification, it is a global phenomenon, or, to borrow from Cuvier, a revolution on the surface of the earth. That afternoon, we emerged onto a dirt road. Silman had collected various plants that interested him to take back to his lab, and these were strapped to his enormous backpack, so that he resembled a cloud forest Johnny Appleseed. The sun was out, but it had recently rained, and clusters of black and red and blue butterflies hovered over the puddles. Occasionally, a truck rumbled by, loaded down with logs. The butterflies couldn't scatter fast enough, so the road was littered with severed wings. We walked until we reached a clutch of tourist lodges. The area we'd entered, Silman told me, was famous among birders, and just trudging along the road, we saw a rainbow assortment of species. Golden tanagers the color of buttercups, blue-gray tanagers the color of cornflowers, and blue-neck tanagers, which are a flash of dazzling turquoise. We also saw a silver-beaked tanager with a bright red belly, and a flock of Andean cock-of-the-rocks, known for their flamboyant scarlet feathers. Male cock-of-the-rocks have a disc-shaped crest on top of their heads, and a raspy call that makes them sound demented. At various points in Earth history, the sorts of creatures now restricted to the tropics had much broader ranges. During the mid-Cretaceous, for example, which lasted from about 120 to 90 million years ago, breadfruit trees flourished as far north as the Gulf of Alaska. In the early Eocene, about 50 million years ago, palms grew in the Antarctic, and crocodiles paddled in the shallow seas around England. There's no reason to suppose, in the abstract, that a warmer world would be any less diverse than a colder one. On the contrary, several possible explanations for the latitudinal diversity gradient suggest that, over the long term, a warmer world would be more varied. In the short term, though, which is to say, on any time scale that's relevant to humans, things look very different. Virtually every species that's around today can be said to be cold-adapted. Golden tanagers and cock-of-the-rocks, not to mention blue jays and cardinals and barn swallows, all made it through the last ice age. Either they or their very close relatives also made it through the ice age before that, and the one before that, and so on going back 2.5 million years. For most of the Pleistocene, temperatures were significantly lower than they are now. Such is the rhythm of the orbital cycle, that glacial periods tend to last much longer than the interglacials, and so an evolutionary premium was placed on being able to deal with wintry conditions. Meanwhile, for 2.5 million years, there's been no advantage in being able to deal with extra heat, since temperatures never got much warmer than they are right now. In the ups and downs of the Pleistocene, we are at the crest of an Alp. To find carbon dioxide levels, and therefore ultimately global temperatures, higher than today's, requires going back a long way, perhaps as far as the mid-Miocene, 15 million years ago. It's quite possible that by the end of this century, CO2 levels could reach a level not seen since the Antarctic palms of the Eocene, some 50 million years ago. Whether species still possess the features that allowed their ancestors to thrive in that ancient, warmer world is at this point impossible to say. For plants to tolerate warmer temperatures, there's all sorts of things that they could do, Silman told me. They could manufacture special proteins. They could change their metabolism, things like that. But thermal tolerance can be costly. And we haven't seen temperatures like those that are predicted in millions of years. So the question is, have plants and animals retained over this huge amount of time, whole radiations of mammals that have come and gone in this period? Have they retained these potentially costly characteristics? If they have, then we may get a pleasant surprise. But what if they haven't? What if they've lost these costly characteristics? Because for so many millions of years, they provided no advantage. If evolution works the way it usually does, Silman said, then the extinction scenario, we don't call it extinction, we talk about it as biotic attrition, a nice euphemism. Well, it starts to look apocalyptic. Chapter 9. Islands on Dry Land. Esseton Burchellii. BR-174 runs from the city of Manaus, in the Brazilian state of Amazonas, more or less due north to the Venezuelan border. The road used to be lined with the wreckage of cars that had skidded off to one side or the other, but since it was paved about 20 years ago, it has become easier to navigate, And now, instead of burned-out hulks, there's an occasional cafe catering to travelers. After an hour or so, the cafes give out, and after another hour, there's a turn-off to a single-lane road, ZF3, that heads due east. ZF3 remains unpaved, and, owing to the color of the dirt in Amazonas, it appears as a bright orange gash tearing through the countryside. Follow ZF3 for another 3/4 of an hour, and you reach a wooden gate, closed with a length of chain. Beyond the gate, some cows are standing around looking sleepy, and beyond the cows is what's known as Reserve 1202. Reserve 1202 might be thought of as an island at the center of the Amazon. I arrived there on a hot, cloudless day in the middle of the rainy season. 50 feet into the reserve, the foliage was so dense that even with the sun directly overhead, the light was still murky, as in a cathedral. From a nearby tree came a high-pitched squeal that made me think of a police whistle. This, I was told, was the call of a small, unassuming bird known as a screaming peehaw. The peehaw screamed again, then fell silent. Unlike a naturally occurring island, Reserve 1202 is an almost perfect square. It is 25 acres of untouched rainforest, surrounded by a sea of scrub. In aerial photos, it shows up as a green raft, bobbing on waves of brown. Reserve 1202 is part of a whole archipelago of Amazonian islands, all with equally clinical-sounding names: Reserve 1112, Reserve 1301, Reserve 2107. Some of the reserves are even smaller than 25 acres. A few are quite a bit bigger. Collectively, they represent one of the world's largest and longest-running experiments, the Biological Dynamics of Forest Fragments Project, or for short, the BDFFP. Pretty much every square foot of the BDFFP has been studied by someone: a botanist tagging trees, an ornithologist banding birds, an entomologist counting fruit flies. When I visited Reserve 1202, I ran into a graduate student from Portugal who was surveying bats. At noon, he had just recently woken up and was eating pasta in a shed that served as a research station come kitchen. While we were talking, a very skinny cowboy rode up on an only slightly less skinny horse. He had a rifle slung over one shoulder. I wasn't sure whether he'd come because he'd heard the truck I'd arrived on and wanted to protect the student from possible intruders, or because he sensed that there was pasta. The BDFFP is the result of an unlikely collaboration between cattlemen and conservationists. In the 1970s, the Brazilian government set out to encourage ranchers to settle north of Manaus, an area that was then largely uninhabited. The program amounted to subsidized deforestation. Any ranchers who agreed to move to the rainforest, cut down the trees, and start raising cows would get a stipend from the government. At the same time, under Brazilian law, landholders in the Amazon had to leave intact at least half the forest on their property. The tension between these two directives gave an American biologist named Tom Lovejoy an idea. What if the ranchers could be convinced to let scientists decide which trees to cut down and which ones to leave standing? The idea was really just one sentence, Lovejoy told me. I wondered if you could persuade the Brazilians to arrange the 50% so you could have a giant experiment. In that case, it would be possible to study in a controlled way a process that was taking place in an uncontrolled fashion all across the tropics, indeed, across the entire world. Lovejoy flew to Manaus and presented his plan to Brazilian officials. Rather to his surprise, they embraced it. The project has now been running continuously for more than 30 years. So many graduate students have been trained at the reserves that a new word was coined to describe them: fragmentologist. For its part, The BDFFP has been called the most important ecological experiment ever done. Currently, about 50 million square miles of land on the planet are ice-free, and this is the baseline that's generally used for calculating human impacts. According to a recent study published by the Geological Society of America, people have directly transformed more than half of this land, roughly 27 million square miles, mostly by converting it to cropland and pasture, but also by building cities and shopping malls and reservoirs, and by logging and mining and quarrying. Of the remaining 23 million square miles, about three-fifths is covered by forest. As the authors put it, natural but not necessarily virgin, and the rest is either high mountains or tundra or desert. According to another recent study, published by the Ecological Society of America, even such dramatic figures understate our impact. The authors of the second study, Earl Ellis of the University of Maryland and Navin Ramankutty of McGill, argue that thinking in terms of biomes defined by climate and vegetation, temperate grasslands, say, or boreal forests, no longer makes sense. Instead, they divide the world up into anthromes. There is an urban anthrome that stretches over 500,000 square miles, an irrigated cropland anthrome, 1 million square miles, and a populated forest, 4.5 million square miles. Ellis and Ramankutty count a total of 18 anthromes, which together extend over 39 million square miles. This leaves outstanding some 11 million square miles. These areas, which are mostly empty of people and include stretches of the Amazon, much of Siberia and northern Canada, and significant expanses of the Sahara, the Gobi, and the Great Victoria Deserts, they call wildlands. But in the Anthropocene, it's not clear that even such wildlands really deserve to be called wild. Tundra is crisscrossed by pipelines, boreal forest by seismic lines. Ranches and plantations and hydroelectric projects slice through the rainforest. In Brazil, people speak of the fishbone, a pattern of deforestation that begins with the construction of one major road, by this metaphor, the spine, that then leads to the creation, sometimes illegal, of lots of smaller rib-like roads. What's left is a forest of long, skinny patches. These days, every wild place has, to one degree or another, been cut into and cut off. And this is what makes Lovejoy's forest fragment experiment so important. With its square, completely unnatural outline, Reserve 1202 represents, increasingly, the shape of the world. The cast at the BDFFP is constantly changing, so even people who have worked on the project for many years are not quite sure whom they're going to bump into there. I drove out to Reserve 1202 with Mario Cohn-Haft, an American ornithologist who first got involved with the project as an intern in the mid-1980s. Cohn-Haft ended up marrying a Brazilian and now has a job at the National Institute of Amazonian Research in Manaus. He is tall and narrow, with wispy gray hair and mournful brown eyes. The kind of affection and enthusiasm Miles Silman brings to tropical trees, Cohn-Haft saves for birds. At one point, I asked him how many Amazonian bird species he could identify by their calls, and he gave me a quizzical look, as if he didn't understand what I was getting at. When I restated the question, the answer turned out to be all of them. By the official count, there are something like 1,300 species of birds in the Amazon, but Cohn-Haft thinks there are actually a good many more, because people have relied too much on features like size and plumage and not paid enough attention to sound. Birds that might look more or less identical, but produce different calls, often turn out, he told me, to be genetically distinct. At the time of our trip, Cohn-Haft was getting ready to publish a paper identifying several new species he had discovered through rigorous listening. One of these, a nocturnal bird in the Poutou family, has a sad, haunting call, which locals sometimes attribute to the Curupira, a figure from Brazilian folklore. The Curupira has a boyish face, copious hair, and backward-pointing feet. He preys on poachers and anyone else who takes too much from the forest. Because dawn is the best time to hear birds, Cohn-Haft and I set out for Reserve 1202 in the dark, shortly after 4 a.m. Our first stop along the way was a metal tower built to support a weather station. From the top of the tower, which was about 130 feet high and in an advanced state of rust, there was a panoramic view over the forest canopy. Cohn-Haft had brought along a powerful scope, which he set up on a tripod. He'd also brought along an iPod and a miniature loudspeaker that fit in his pocket. The iPod was loaded with recordings of hundreds of calls, and sometimes, when he heard a bird he couldn't locate, he would play its song in the hope that it would reveal itself. By the end of the day, you could have heard 150 species of birds and only seen 10, he told me. Occasionally there was a glint of color against the green, and in this way I managed to glimpse what Cohn-Haft identified as a yellow-tufted woodpecker, a black-tailed tatira, and a golden-winged parakeet. He trained the scope on a speck of blue that turned out to be the most beautiful bird I have ever seen, a red-legged honeycreeper, with a sapphire breast, scarlet legs, and a cap of brilliant aquamarine. As the sun rose higher and the calls grew less frequent, we set out again. By the time the day had turned furnace-like and we were both dripping with sweat, we got to the chained gate that marks the entrance to Reserve 1202. Cohn-Haft chose one of the paths that have been cut into the reserve for access, and we tromped to what he thought was roughly the square's center. He stopped to listen. There wasn't much to hear. Right now, I'm hearing only two bird species, he told me. One of them sounds like it's saying, whoops, looks like rain. And that's a plumbeous pigeon. It's a classic primary forest species. The other is doing this choodle-choodle-peep kind of thing. He made a sound like a flutist doing warm-up exercises. And that's a rufous-browed pepper-shrike. And that's a typical second-growth or edge-of-pasture species that we wouldn't hear in primary forest. Cohn-Haft explained that when he had first worked at Reserve 1202, his job was to catch and band birds and then release them, a process known by the shorthand ring and fling. The birds were caught in nets strung across the forest from the ground to a height of 6 feet. Bird censuses were conducted before the forest fragments were isolated, and then afterward, so that the numbers could be compared. Across the reserves, there are 11 in total, Cohn-Haft and his colleagues banded nearly 25,000 birds. The first result that kind of surprised everyone, although it's sort of trivial in the grand scheme of things, was kind of a refugee effect, he said, as we stood in the shadows. What happened when you cut down the surrounding forest is that the capture rate, just the number of birds you captured and the number of species sometimes too, went up for about the first year. Apparently, birds from the deforested areas were seeking shelter in the fragments. But gradually, as time went on, both the number and the variety of birds in the fragments started to drop. And then it kept on dropping. In other words, Cohn-Haft said, there wasn't just suddenly this new equilibrium with fewer species. There was this steady degradation in the diversity over time. And what went for birds went for other groups as well. Islands. We are talking about real islands now, rather than islands of habitat, tend to be species poor, or, to use the term of art, depauperate. This is true of volcanic islands situated in the middle of the ocean, and it is also, more intriguingly, true of so-called land bridge islands that are located close to shore. Researchers who have studied landbridge islands, which are created by fluctuating sea levels, have consistently found that they are less diverse than the continents they were once part of. Why is this so? Why should diversity drop off with isolation? For some species, the answer seems pretty straightforward. The slice of the habitat they've been marooned on is inadequate. A big cat that requires a range of 40 square miles isn't likely to make it for long in an area of only 20 square miles. A tiny frog that lays its eggs in a pond and feeds on a hillside needs both a pond and a hillside to survive. But if a lack of suitable habitat were the only issue, landbridge islands should pretty quickly stabilize at a new, lower level of diversity. Yet they don't. They keep on bleeding species, a process that's known by the surprisingly sunny term, relaxation. On some landbridge islands that were created by rising sea levels at the end of the Pleistocene, it's been estimated that full relaxation took thousands of years. On others, the process may still be going on. Ecologists account for relaxation by observing that life is random. Smaller areas harbor smaller populations, and smaller populations are more vulnerable to chance. To use an extreme example, an island might be home to a single breeding pair of birds of species X. One year, the pair's nest is blown out of a tree in a hurricane. The following year, all the chicks turn out to be males, and the year after that, the nest is raided by a snake. Species X is now headed toward local extinction. If the island is home to two breeding pairs, the odds that both will suffer such a string of fatal bad luck is lower, and if it's home to 20 pairs, it's a great deal lower. But low odds in the long run can still be deadly. The process might be compared to a coin toss. It's unlikely that a coin is going to come up heads 10 times in a row, the first 10 or 20 or 100 times it is flipped. However, if it's tossed often enough, even an unlikely sequence is likely to occur. The rules of probability are so robust that empirical evidence of the risks of small population size is hardly necessary. Nevertheless, it's available. In the 1950s and 60s, bird watchers kept meticulous records of every pair that bred on Bardsey Island, off Wales, from common house sparrows and oyster catchers to much rarer plovers and curlews. In the 1980s, these records were analyzed by Jared Diamond, who at that time was working as an ornithologist, specializing in the birds of New Guinea. Diamond found that the odds that any particular species had gone missing from the island could be plotted along a curve whose slope declined exponentially as the number of pairs increased. Thus, he wrote, the main predictor of local extinction was small population size. Small populations, of course, aren't confined to islands. A pond may have a small population of frogs, a meadow a small population of voles. And in the ordinary course of events, local extinctions occur all the time. But when such an extinction follows from a run of bad luck, the site is likely to be recolonized by members of other, more fortunate populations wandering in from somewhere else. What distinguishes islands and explains the phenomenon of relaxation is that recolonization is so difficult in many cases, effectively impossible. While a landbridge island may support a small remnant population of, say, tigers, if that population winks out, new tigers presumably aren't going to paddle over. The same holds true for any sort of habitat fragment. Depending on what surrounds the fragment, species may or may not be able to recolonize it once a population has been lost. Researchers at the BDFFP have found, for example, that some birds, such as white-crowned manakins, will readily cross road clearings, while others, such as scale-backed ant birds, are extremely reluctant to do so. In the absence of recolonization, local extinctions can become regional, and then, eventually, global. Some 10 miles from Reserve 1202, the dirt road peters out, and a stretch of rainforest that counts by contemporary standards as undisturbed begins. Researchers at the BDFFP have marked off sections of this forest to use as control plots so they can compare what's happening in the fragments to what's going on in the continuous forest. Near the end of the road, there's a small camp, known as Camp 41, where they sleep and eat and try to escape from the rain. I arrived there with Cone Haft one afternoon just as the sky opened up. We jogged through the forest, but it really didn't matter. By the time we got to Camp 41, we were drenched. Later, after the downpour had stopped and we'd squeezed out our socks, we headed away from the camp, deeper into the forest. The sky was still overcast, and in the gray, there was a dark and somber tint to all the greenery. I thought of the Kurupira, lurking in the trees on his backward feet. E.O. Wilson, who visited the BDFFP twice, wrote after one of his trips, "The jungle teems, but in a manner mostly beyond the reach of the human senses." Cone Haft told me much the same thing, if somewhat less grandiloquently. "The rainforest," he said, "looks a lot better on TV." At first it seemed to me there was nothing moving anywhere around us. But then Cone Haft began pointing out the signs of insect life, and I began to see lots of activity going on in, to use Wilson's phrase, the little world underneath. A stick bug hung from a dead leaf, waving its delicate legs. A spider crouched on a hoop-shaped web. A phallic tube of mud sticking up from the forest floor turned out to be the home of a cicada larva. What looked like a monstrous pregnancy bulging from a tree trunk was revealed to be a nest filled with termites. Cone Haft recognized a plant known as a melastome. He turned over one of its leaves and tapped on the stem, which was hollow. Tiny black ants poured out, looking as ferocious as tiny black ants can look. The ants, he explained, protect the plant from other insects in return for receiving free lodging. Cone Haft grew up in western Massachusetts, as it happens, not far from where I live. "Back home, I thought of myself as a general naturalist," he told me. He could name most of the trees and the insects he came across in western New England, in addition to all of the birds. But in the Amazon, it was impossible to be a generalist. There was just too much to keep track of. In the BDFFP's study plots, some 1,400 species of trees have been identified, even more than in Silman's plots, 1,000 miles to the west. These are mega-diverse ecosystems, where every single species is very, very specialized, Cone Haft told me. And in these ecosystems, there's a huge premium on doing exactly what you do. He offered his own theory for why life in the tropics is so various, which is that diversity tends to be self-reinforcing. A natural corollary to high species diversity is low population density, and that's a recipe for speciation. Isolation by distance, he explained. It's also, he added, a vulnerability, since small, isolated populations are that much more susceptible to extinction. The sun was starting to sink, and in the forest it was already twilight. As we were heading back toward Camp 41, we came upon a troop of ants following a path of their own just a few feet from ours. The reddish-brown ants were moving roughly in a straight line that led over to a, to them especially, large log. They marched up the log and then down again. I followed the column as far as I could in both directions, but it seemed to go on and on and on, like a Soviet-style parade. The column, Cone Haft told me, consisted of army ants that belonged to the species Esetun burchellii. Army ants, there are dozens of species in the tropics, differ from most other ants in that they have no fixed home. They spend their time either on the move hunting for insects, spiders, and the occasional small lizard, or camped out in temporary bivouacs. Esseton Burchellii bivouacs are made up of the ants themselves, arrayed around the queen in a vicious, stinging ball. Army ants are famously voracious. A colony on the march can consume 30,000 prey, mostly the larvae of other insects, per day. But in their very rapacity, they support a host of other species. There's a whole class of birds known as obligate ant followers. These are almost always found around ant swarms, eating insects the ants have flushed out of the leaf litter. Other birds are opportunistic ant followers and peck around the ants when, by chance, they encounter them. After the ant-following birds, trail a variety of other creatures that are also experts at doing exactly what they do. There are butterflies that feed on the birds' droppings, and parasitic flies that deposit their young on startled crickets and cockroaches. Several species of mites hitch rides aboard the ants themselves. One species fastens itself to the ant's legs, another to its mandibles. A pair of American naturalists, Carl and Marion Rettenmeier, who spent more than half a century studying Ecaton Burchellii, came up with a list of more than 300 species that live in association with the ants. Conehaft didn't hear any birds and it was getting late, so we headed back to camp. We agreed that we would return to the same spot the next day to try to catch the ant-bird-butterfly procession. In the late 1970s, an entomologist named Terry Irwin was working in Panama when someone asked him how many species of insects he thought could be found in a couple of acres of tropical forest. Up to then, Irwin had mostly been a beetle counter. He'd been spraying the tops of trees with insecticide, then collecting the carcasses that showered down from the leaves in a brittle rain. Intrigued by the larger question of how many insect species there were in the tropics as a whole, he thought about how he might extrapolate from his own experience. From a single species of tree, Luhea simanii, he had collected beetles belonging to more than 950 species. Figuring that about a fifth of these beetles depended on Luhea simanii, that other beetles similarly depended on other trees, that beetles represent about 40% of all insect species, and that there are roughly 50,000 species of tropical trees, Irwin estimated that the tropics were home to as many as 30 million species of arthropods. In addition to insects, the group includes spiders and centipedes. He was, he acknowledged, shocked by his own conclusion. Since then, many efforts have been made to refine Irwin's estimates. Most have tended to revise the numbers downward. Among other things, Irwin probably overstated the proportion of insects dependent on a single host plant. Still, by all accounts, the figure remains shockingly high. Recent estimates suggest there are at least 2 million tropical insect species, and perhaps as many as 7 million. By comparison, there are only about 10,000 species of birds in the entire world, and only 5,500 species of mammals. Thus, for every species with hair and mammary glands, there are, in the tropics alone, at least 300 with antennae and compound eyes. The richness of its insect fauna means that any threat to the tropics translates into very high numbers of potential victims. Consider the following calculation. Tropical deforestation is notoriously difficult to measure, but let's assume that the forests are being felled at a rate of 1% annually. Using the species-area relationship, S equals CA to the Z, and setting the value of Z at 0.25, we can calculate that losing 1% of the original area implies the loss of roughly 0.25% of the original species. If we assume, very conservatively, that there are 2 million species in the tropical rainforests, this means that something like 5,000 species are being lost each year. This comes to roughly 14 species a day, or one every 100 minutes. This exact calculation was performed by E.O. Wilson in the late 1980s, not long after one of his trips to the BDFFP. Wilson published the results in Scientific American, and on the basis of them, he concluded that the contemporary extinction rate was on the order of 10,000 times greater than the naturally occurring background rate. This, he further observed, was reducing biological diversity to its lowest level since the end Cretaceous extinction, an event he noted that, while not the worst mass extinction in history, was by far the most famous because it ended the age of the dinosaurs, conferred hegemony on the mammals, and ultimately, for better or worse, made possible the origin of our own species. Like Irwin's, Wilson's calculations were shocking. They were also easy to grasp, or at least to repeat, and they received a great deal of attention, not just in the relatively small world of tropical biologists, but also in the mainstream media. Hardly a day passes without one being told that tropical deforestation is extinguishing roughly one species every hour, or maybe even one every minute, a pair of British ecologists lamented. 25 years later, it's now generally agreed that Wilson's figures, here again like Irwin's, don't match observation, a fact that should be chastening to science writers, perhaps even more than to scientists. What the reasons are for this continue to be debated. One possibility is that extinction takes time. Wilson's calculations assume that once an area is deforested, species drop out more or less immediately. But it may take quite a while for a forest to fully relax, and even small remnant populations can persist for a long time, depending on the roll of the survival dice. The difference between the number of species that have been doomed by some sort of environmental change and the number that have actually vanished is often referred to as the extinction debt. The term implies there's a lag to the process, just as there is to buying on credit. Another possible explanation is that habitat lost to deforestation isn't really lost. Even forests that have been logged for timber or burned for pasture can and do regrow. Ironically enough, a good illustration of this comes from the area right around the BDFFP. Not long after Lovejoy convinced Brazilian officials to back the project, the country suffered a paralyzing debt crisis, and by 1990 the inflation rate was running at 30,000%. The government canceled the subsidies that had been promised the ranchers, and thousands of acres were abandoned. Around some of the BDFFP's square fragments, the trees grew back so vigorously that the plots would have been swallowed up entirely had Lovejoy not arranged to have them re-isolated by cutting and burning the new growth. Though primary forest continues to decline in the tropics, secondary forest in some regions is on the rise. Yet another possible explanation for why observations don't match predictions is that humans aren't very observant. Since the majority of species in the tropics are insects and other invertebrates, so too are the majority of anticipated extinctions. But as we don't know, even to the nearest million, how many tropical insect species there are, we're not likely to notice if one or two or even 10,000 of them have vanished. A recent report by the Zoological Society of London notes that the conservation status of less than 1% of all described invertebrates is known, and the vast majority of invertebrates probably have not yet even been described. Invertebrates may, as Wilson has put it, be the little things that run the world, but little things are easy to overlook. By the time Cone Haft and I got back to Camp 41, several other people had arrived, including Cone Haft's wife, Gita Mesquita, who's an ecologist, and Tom Lovejoy, who was in Manaus, attending a meeting of a group called the Amazonas Sustainable Foundation. Now in his early 70s, Lovejoy is credited with having put the term biological diversity into general circulation.